Mark Thompson on Music Mill FM.
Hello, you're listening to the Music Mill, and I'm Mark Thompson, here with you for the next hour. I'm joined first by Assistant Editor of Conservative Home, Henry Hill, to discuss votes at 16. 16 and 17-year-olds have had a vote in the Scottish referendum last year, and the Lords have now voted for similar in the impending EU referendum. Would this be a good thing? Do under-18s understand the issues well enough to make an informed decision? Well, we'll talk to Henry about this. We'll also spend some time discussing the Chancellor's autumn statement. Has he dodged the tax credits bullet? And if so, how has he managed to execute a U-turn that might have severely damaged the career of lesser politicians? And then later we'll be joined by old-school TV enthusiast Steve Williams to discuss InVision continuity. If you recall, back in the day, mainly on ITV, lots of the regions had continuity announcers who we could see, usually sitting behind a desk. In some ways, that gave the viewer a strong connection with the station in a way perhaps you don't get anymore. And have we lost something here? And could maybe some of the hyper-local TV stations that have started recently maybe resurrect such an idea?
Contact Mark now. Tweet at Mark Reckons.
So if you want to get in touch, I'm on Twitter, at Mark Reckons. You can tweet your thoughts about today's topics or anything else. And you can also email me on markreckons@live.co.uk, either during the show or if you're listening to the podcast version anytime. And we'll discuss votes for 16-year-olds after this. OK, so as I said, we are going to be talking about votes at 16. Well, this is an issue that sort of has come to the fore in the last couple of years. I think it's one of those things that has probably been floating around in the background, and I'm certain there have been campaigns about it over the years. But it really came to the fore last year because in the Scottish referendum, the Scottish Parliament actually decided that 16 and 17-year-olds could vote. The argument, one of the primary arguments, was that the decision is going to affect everyone in that country for many years to come. And therefore younger people should have a vote. And a similar argument is now being made regarding the EU referendum, and indeed the House of Lords have just voted to allow it, so it's gone back to the Commons. Now, I have my own views on this, but I'm joined by someone who I think has perhaps slightly different views to me. I'm delighted to be joined by Henry Hill, who is Assistant Editor of Conservative Home. Good evening, Henry.
Good evening.
How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I understand you're hanging around in a corridor in the House of Commons at the moment.
Yeah, we just finished a meeting, and I couldn't get anywhere more secluded. So this will have to do.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us tonight. So, as I've just outlined, I think my view broadly is that I think it's probably a good thing on balance for 16 and 17-year-olds to have a vote in the upcoming EU referendum, and actually probably in all future elections and referenda as well. I mean, but you take a slightly different view, don't you?
I do. Yes, I'm not rigidly dogmatic about it, but on balance, I'm opposed to vote for 16.
Okay. And do you want to just outline your reasons why?
Sure. Okay, so in any situation where you have a universal franchise, as we do, but you don't want literally everyone to vote, you have to have some sort of cut-off. Now, currently the cut-off is 18. The argument is that it should be reduced to 16. But in my view, 16-year-olds are actually less equipped now to exercise the franchise than they have been for decades, because the entire direction of government policy in every other area is entirely in the contrary direction. It used to be that 16, you were functionally an adult. You could have left school at 15 back in the 70s and 80s. You would most likely be in a job. There was a real possibility of you serving in the forces or getting married. And you could be well on the way. You could smoke. It's the age of consent for sex. And you could be well on the way to being an adult. But these days, you can't leave school till you're 18. You can't smoke anymore. Most of those responsibilities that we used to give young people at 16, which people I had at 16, we've taken away from them. And clearly the direction is that we feel that childhood is lengthening, and that the period of time in which they aren't responsible for their own actions is increasing. And I think that it's fairly ridiculous to give the vote to people who wouldn't be allowed to rent the thick of it if they went into a DVD store.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I can see a point from that perspective. But are things moving in the direction that you suggest? I mean, I understand that there have been various legislative ratchets that have been applied to certain things that, you know, say when I was 16 or 17, I was allowed to do. I mean, I was allowed to smoke when I was 16. In fact, I'm sure I smoked before I was 16 as well. But certainly I was legally allowed to go into shops and buy cigarettes at 16. I was allowed to drive a car at 17. I believe the age for driving still is 17, but I think from your piece you mentioned that they may well change that in the future. I know there has been talk about that.
They've looked at raising the driving age. During the parliament before last.
Yeah, so I understand your point from that perspective, but actually, young people are so connected in ways that they weren't, say, back in the 70s or 80s when I were a lad. You know, there's social media and there's all kinds of different ways in which young people can stay in touch with both other young people and older people and plug into the political process and all the rest of it. I mean, isn't it only natural that given all the other ways in which people can get involved with things and campaigns and so forth, that young people would actually also want the vote?
Well, I mean, the thing about this is, I mean, I do concede that there is a counter case, but I don't think it's a particularly strong one, because whilst it's theoretically true, you've got the sort of techno-utopian vision of the internet, you're letting everybody stay informed on the issues. That isn't really the experience of the internet. An awful lot of people sort of use the internet to consume entertainment, or if they do consume views, it actually makes it easier for people to zero in on the views they already hold and to sort of have those reinforced, because you no longer need to buy a package like a newspaper, which will contain a range of opinion, however narrow or broad. You can really sort of micro-pick what you read. And I think the problem we have is I would be open to vote for 16 if it was pegged to a universal age of consent. If we had a debate, a serious, comprehensive debate in this country about when you are an adult citizen and when you should have the responsibilities and rights of an adult citizen. And I think that that's a strong argument to make. But I think that the alternative argument is the fact that if we are going to be drawing a line in the sand, and that's what an age limit is. There will always be people under the age limit who we would assess as being capable of voting. Where do you draw it? At 16 is just an equally arbitrary line these days. It's no longer the school leaving age. It no longer has many of these important things, these important benchmarks that I previously outlined. So if we're going to have votes at 16, the argument has to then be, why don't we have votes at 15? Why don't we have votes at 14? If we're going to allocate the franchise on the basis of everybody after this point gets it, nobody before this point gets it, then the argument for why it should be a certain age is a very important one. And I think that the votes at 16 is actually based on a set of assumptions, none of which hold true anymore.
Well, I mean, one thing that has occurred to me during this debate is, I mean, when I was at school, 30 years ago, nearly 30 years ago, it was true, actually, that you could leave school very early. I mean, I think that whole leaving school at 15 thing had pretty much been phased out by the time I was that age. But I know a few years earlier that had been possible, and I know people of my parents' generation would leave school at 14, some of them. So that has obviously changed. But most children and young adults do stay on in some form of further education beyond 15, 16 nowadays. And one thing that occurred to me in this whole thing is that trying to get young people engaged with the political process is something that I constantly hear politicians talking about and bemoaning the fact that lots of young people aren't as engaged as they'd perhaps like them to be, and the turnout figures for... I mean, you haven't even mentioned this. This might even be a good argument from your perspective, Henry, but the turnout figures for the cohort of 18 to 25-year-olds is pitifully low. I mean, you know, so maybe from your side, the argument could also be that even if the franchise was extended down to 60, not that many of them are likely to take advantage of it. However, the reason I'm saying this is because perhaps giving 16 and 17-year-olds the vote whilst they're still at school or college could encourage schools to perhaps have lessons focused around, let's say, an election that was coming up, a local election, a European election, a referendum, a general election. And rather than it being a sort of theoretical abstract thing that in a few years, children, you will be allowed to vote, perhaps if your birthday happens to fall, you know, at the right point whenever the next important election is. Instead, it could be more around, well, actually, there is an election in a few weeks' time and you will be able to vote, and we're going to talk about the issues all around it. And that might help engage young people. And there's a lot of evidence that if people vote in the first election that they're eligible for, they're far more likely to vote in future elections as well. So isn't that a good argument for saying, actually, the cutoff of 18 is perhaps... I understand your point of view that you think it's arbitrary, but if we're going to set it anywhere, wouldn't 16 be actually a more sensible, pragmatic point for the reasons I've just said?
I think to quickly address a point that you mentioned briefly about the direction of travel in other areas, and how that more children are more pupils and young adults are staying in education longer and longer and longer. I actually think that the truth that dare not speak its name, if we had a full and frank debate about the franchises, that if we were to make the franchise age consistent with the rest of government policy, the discussion would be about raising it, not lowering it. But I think that my enormous worry about giving people the vote at school with that explicit intention that you outlined is that when somebody is at school, they are hugely at the mercy is the wrong phrase, but the whole purpose of school is to mold minds that we consider to be unready to move out into the world and make their own independent judgments. Now that's the whole purpose of keeping people in school. That is what mandatory education says about the person that you are forcing to stay in school. So I think that the idea of giving young people the vote with the explicit intention that their school would try to turn them into voters has enormous question marks about, you know, it would be lovely if you could guarantee that a school would deliver to a child this sort of rigorously impartial discussion, but I actually think that that's incredibly difficult to do, and I think it's a very heavy burden to place on teachers and places of education. I think that if we are saying that people of a certain age, be it 16, are unready to leave school, that they are not ready to form independent judgments in the adult world, then it is wrong to make schools political battleground.
But, I mean, isn't it true, though, that children are already exposed to all kinds of different ideas? I mean, if you look at something like history, I mean, there's all kinds of different potential interpretations of history. And history teachers, you know, try to walk that line and they try to give different sides of, you know, whatever happened in certain wars and certain battles and so forth. I mean, obviously, you know, when you learn about the Second World War, it's obviously going to be, you know, somewhat biased in favour of our side that our country fought on because we're all British. But at the same time, the children are capable of absorbing and processing complex information. And I mean, surely the far stronger influence on children will be the family background anyway and how their parents vote. And that was ever thus anyway. That shouldn't be really an argument for denying them the vote, should it?
I think the argument for denying them the vote is actually an awful lot bigger than that. I think it was an argument against this specific suggestion for giving them the vote. I mean, as a historian, I completely agree with you about the political implications of the study of history, and I actually think that the fact that impartial history is essentially almost impossible to teach highlights the risks of making an institution in any way responsible for the political engagement of the young. And we also forget, of course, that the pressure on schools as political battlefields will increase exponentially once, if we give all sixth formers, for example, the vote, then suddenly these will be captive voters. And while currently influencing 16-year-olds is a rather academic exercise and politicians can take a sort of disinterested view, that will completely change if these are voters who are corralled 5 days a week in a particular institution. The pressures will shift. So I don't think it's fair to advance an argument based on the way that schools treat people currently, once you have changed something quite fundamental about why they should have the vote. But I think that the fundamental point is still that if we are saying that these people cannot leave school, if they can't smoke, if they can't decide to buy pornography, if they can't decide to drink, then they shouldn't have the vote. Now, as I said at the beginning, I'm not dogmatically against votes at 16, but I believe that we should have a consistent policy on all of these issues. I think that the debate should not be one debate on the vote, one debate on cigarettes, one debate on alcohol. I think there should be a well-informed debate from principle about when we become a citizen and when we acquire wholesale the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. And I think that it is actually a sign of the lack of respect that we give the franchise, we, the generation who've never had to fight for it, who've never had to campaign against a government that denied us it, who've never had to fight against a foreign power that would strip us of it, that we the important decisions about cigarettes and alcohol, we don't think that 16-year-olds can take, but the vote is something that we can, that harmless, that we can give them. And I'm in favour of a universal age of majority, and if that's at 16, then I would support votes at 16 as long as it came with all of the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. But I think that those rights and responsibilities are a prerequisite of the franchise.
OK, just putting aside the more general point about votes at 16, because it's pretty clear where you stand, it's obviously pretty clear where I stand. Sure. Would you be willing to make an exception for the EU referendum? Because that is a decision. That's not for 5 years, that's for decades and decades. I mean, the last time we had one was 40 years ago before I was eligible to vote because I was 1 year old. That's going to make such a fundamental difference to the nature of our country and the direction in which it goes that, you know, the people who are 16 and 17 around the time that the referendum is held are going to have to live with the consequences of that decision. So wouldn't it be right in that one special one-off case to give them the vote for it?
I don't think so, personally, because I don't want to step away from the principle. This is a decision, whether we stay in the European Union, like our government and like everything else, is a decision that needs to be taken by the electorate and by the people who we deem fit to constitute the electorate. Now, as a unionist, I profited from the decision of the Scottish government to give 16 and 17-year-olds the vote because the unionists won the huge majority of school referendums held up and down Scotland, and I think the evidence is that most of the evidence is that young people broke the union, but that doesn't change the fundamental principle, which is that either we consider these people fit for the privilege of the franchise, or we don't. And I genuinely do not support this idea of the unprincipled exception, which is where we have a set of beliefs, but we make one specific exception. Because, well, of course, once you've made that exception, and once people have, it's just like you've seen in Scotland, once people have voted in the European referendum, people will say, well, they voted in that, and that was a big life-changing decision. We trust them with a big life-changing decision that will affect generations to come. Why don't we trust them with the relatively piddling argument about who governs us for the next 5 years? So I think that, in point of fact, the fact that the European argument is more important actually mitigates against the idea of being laxer with the franchise than in a normal election.
OK. Thanks very much for your comments on that, Henry. Just before I let you go,
sure.
Can we just briefly talk about the Autumn Statement, which has obviously been held very recently? In particular, I'm intrigued by how George Osborne, the Chancellor, appears to have managed to get out of jail on the question of tax credits. I mean, I'll be honest, I've been very busy since the Autumn Statement, and I've not really had a chance to look at any commentary on this or any opinion pieces. So I'm just shooting from the hip here. I'm just interpreting it as I see it. But I basically think that he has got away with something here that until today, I couldn't really see how he was going to get out of it, because he'd nailed his colours to the tax credit reform mast so strongly and had resisted the calls up until now. And yet I couldn't really see how he was going to, you know, come up with mitigating. I mean, you know, if you think back to how Gordon Brown managed to try and resolve the 10p tax debacle, and it was with just further complicated measures piled on top of complicated measures, and I thought George Osborne was going to tie himself up in knots doing that, and his political capital was going to take a severe battering. But actually, all he's done is a good old-fashioned U-turn, and he seems to have pretty much completely got away with it. He's used the cover of the OBR coming up with this extra $27 billion of money that appeared to be down the back of the sofa. But I think we all know this is a political choice, and he's made it because he was going to lose eventually in the Commons if it came back there, because so many of his backbenchers were against it. So how do you view his Houdini act here? And do you think that actually marks him out as a very strong candidate for future Prime Minister, given how he's managed to get himself out of this?
I think it's hard to judge what its impact on whether or not he'd be a good leader, because on the one hand there's obviously much to be said for the leader with the ability to swallow their pride and identify the point for a cautious retreat, and on the other hand there's the case for the leader who if they think it's a good policy tries by hook or by crook to get this onto the statute book. I think that my reading, and I have also been busy after the statement, but I didn't see the statement. The interesting thing about the tax credits is that the opposition parties, the Labour and the Liberal Democrats, they really didn't play much of a role. The big sources of pressure on the government were Tory backbenchers and, astonishingly, the House of Lords. And so that's the dynamic now. The political dynamic, the Labour opposition is so ineffectual that the key political dynamic is the debate between the different sections of the Tory parties. And in this instance, it was the front bench and sort of the progressive backbenchers, or at least backbenchers with marginal seats to the extent that they overlap. And so Osborne saw that instead of tying himself in knots and having to revisit the question, he got to rip the bandage off with one fell swoop, and there will be a few days of U-turn headlines, which most voters I don't think particularly care about, and then the issue is buried. And it's robbed Labour of one of the few lines of attack they had that was really hitting home. So in my view, he's been given the space to retreat by the fact that the opposition is not pressuring the government in the way that an effective opposition would be expected to, despite the fact, of course, that John McDonnell reneged on his promise not to try and exploit any government U-turn on tax credits. Even when he went for the kill, he just couldn't land a blow.
Yeah, I tweeted something very similar to that actually today, that it, as I heard John McDonnell's response, he was doing exactly what he promised he wouldn't do, and regardless of whether you thought his promise was a good idea or not, he did promise it. Frankly, his response seemed to be, sixes and sevens, really. In terms of where we go from here, I mean, do you think that Osborne is now going to have plain sailing between now and whenever the leadership election is? Because it's not like he hasn't got form for this sort of thing. The Omni Shambles budget of 2012, all kind, pasty tax and the caravan tax and all of that stuff, and it's well documented now. I mean, obviously he denied it in public, but behind the scenes he kind of went away and he had a really good think and seemed to kind of renew himself. He even like lost weight and he seemed to come out of that a kind of renewed figure. And do you think the kind of baptism of fire that this has done for him will stand him in good stead, and we won't see any more of this stuff? There'll be, much more straightforward budgets that don't fiddle around with stuff like this, because, it's almost like touching a third rail, isn't it?
Yeah, I think one of the great commendations of Osborne for the leadership is that, and I'm not a backer of his, is that he has shown a proven ability to adapt. Both to retreat when he needs to, which is a precious and often quite rare quality, and also to actually learn from his mistakes and reassess himself. And you were right to talk about remodelling. Is it plain sailing? I don't think so. The European referendum is the most obvious problem for any Conservative administration. George is in. Cameron is in. The managing the tensions within the party during that referendum is going to be very tricky, and especially, as we've reported on Conservative Home, there's some evidence that CCHQ is playing fast and loose with the party's solemn vow to remain officially neutral. And I think that from a party management perspective, that will be tricky. Obviously, if we vote out and he's led in, that's the end of Osborne's leadership ambitions. I mean, will there be fiscal challenges over the next 2 years? Yes, of course there will. We still have a small majority. We still have a rebellious House of Lords, which is constitutionally unprecedented, I think, in the last 100 years or so. So there will be challenges, but I think that certainly Osborne probably won't try anything quite as aggressive and full frontal as the assault on tax credits was.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time, Henry. How can people read your writings and follow you on social media and that sort of thing?
Well, if they go conservativehome.com, and I write the column on Scotland and Wales once a week, and I normally write two or three times a week. In addition to that, I'm on Twitter at @HCH_Hill.
Okay, good stuff. Thanks very much for your time today, Henry.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
All right, good stuff.
Mark Thompson on Music Mill FM.
Going to now be talking about something that's a little bit of a passion of mine. Sometimes when I'm a bit bored, I go to YouTube and I go through some footage of old television continuity, mainly from ITV, sometimes from the BBC. And one thing that's very noticeable is that quite often back in the day, I mean, not always, but quite often on ITV stations, say 30 years ago, there was InVision continuity, which I remember, and I remember seeing it when I was a kid myself, where you actually could see the presenters and they were maybe sitting behind a desk, and it sort of gave you a feeling of connection with the station that perhaps you don't get anymore, because you don't generally tend to see that. Presenters are generally just talking over the end credits of a programme or over an advert or something. Well, I'm joined by Steve Williams, who's a cultural commentator and a bit of an expert on old school television. Good evening, Steve.
Good evening, Mark.
This is the hot topic that I think everyone's talking about today. And I know we've had the autumn statement, but really, InVision continuity, it's where it's at. I mean, are you like me? Are you a fan of that way of TV presentation?
I am, yeah. It's something about the internet approach, as you were saying just then, about how you have a connection with the station. I think especially to, I think, where you are in the southwest, when you had people like Ian Stirling on TSW and before that on Westwood. I know there's a story that Jan Leeming joined the Westwood team of announcers, and she was introduced, and they'd introduced her to the viewers. She hadn't actually started, but then she had to go into hospital, so she didn't appear on air, and she had so many letters and cards, despite the fact she never actually started, because people thought she was part of the family, and Westwood introduced this new announcer, and they were going they were going to make her part of the family, and they were going to get used to her, and she was welcome in their homes, and so it was very much an intimate approach in those days to television, which maybe you don't get so much these days.
Yeah. It seems a lot more anonymous these days, doesn't it? I mean, you know, I'll recognise the voice of a continuity announcer or someone who's speaking over an advert for a television station. The bloke who played Eddie, who ran the bar in Hustle, seems to do quite a lot of voiceovers on, I think, Channel 5. Mm. But I'm one of those people who can generally pick out people's voices in adverts. Anyway, I tend to know who they are.
Yeah.
I'm probably a bit strange in that respect, but really, it's pretty anonymous, isn't it? And they can just interchange them as much as they like. And I guess also they can just do it once from one studio in London rather than have to do it 16 times across 16 different studios.
Indeed, and it's all about the marketing as well, because a lot of these announcements now, I mean, if you look on some of the clips on YouTube, for example, I mean, in the days of InVision announcers, people like Colin Weston or Granada, I mean, before a big movie premiere like Ghostbusters, he would do some birthday greetings, and you think, well, this is peak time, with millions and millions of people watching, and you can get a proper direct message here targeted at the audience, and the announcer's doing some birthday greetings. And it was the same, I know Andy Crane talks about when he's in the broom cupboard, and before Neighbours, they had 10 million viewers watching, 12 million viewers watching, but nobody said, oh, can you please promote these programs, because these are top priorities for us. They would talk about Ed the Duck going to Cubs, and that was the kind of thing that you had in those days before it was all very much targeted, and there were people who were employed to work out the optimum time to do a message and the optimum way to say it to get X equals Y on the balance sheet. It was a time when people did have the flexibility to do what they wanted.
Yeah, it's interesting you should mention the broom cupboard, because actually when I was thinking about this, I'd forgotten about that, of course. I mean, Philip Schofield was the first broom cupboard presenter, wasn't he, in 1985, and then it was Andy Crane and Simon Parkin. I think there were a few others as well, who kind of came after him as well. But of course, CBeebies still does that. I mean, CBeebies has InVision continuity announcers. They're just in a kind of studio with a load of toys, and they're dressed up and they dance around and do silly things. So, in a way, they're still sort of carrying that torch, aren't they?
Indeed, and I suppose it still exists on CBC as well, of course. But I think it was considered a bit too cosy to do it in adult television. But, I mean, in terms of getting a relationship going, I was always a BBC child when I was growing up, because you had the broom cupboard, you had this very intimate approach, and you got to know the presenters as a family, whereas on ITV they seem to change it around every so often, and all these new presenters coming in, and you didn't get the sort of intimate approach, and didn't get the family feeling that you got from the broom cupboard and for the ITV announcers. I mean, if you looked around the country, there were people in the southwest, got Ian Stirling, in the northwest, you had people like Colin Weston. You had Tom Edwards on Thames, who's a very raffish character, very big on sort of bit cheeky. And then you had up in the northeast, you had people like Bill Steele, who was very affable. And I know he liked doing it so much that he actually had it written in his contract that he would be allowed to do InVision continuity for as long as he worked in the company. So they had to keep it going for many, many more years than they would have done otherwise, because Bill Steele had in his contract that he was allowed to be InVision because he enjoyed being InVision so much.
That's brilliant. I didn't know that. That's excellent. I mean, you've mentioned, obviously, a few there. I mean, I grew up in the Northwest.
Yeah.
So the one I'm most familiar with was Granada. And I mean, Colin Weston was my favourite. There were others as well. There was Charles Foster, Jim Pope. Mm. Jim Pope, who was actually the chap who did for many years the voiceover on University Challenge as well.
Yeah.
When announcing the names of the people who just buzzed in. But Colin Weston, like I say, was my favourite. And I don't know if this is now an apocryphal memory, but I have a memory of something going wrong with some programme or some film, and they cut back to the InVision continuity announcer, who was Colin Weston.
Mm.
And he had to fill for like minutes and minutes and minutes on live television, like you said, to probably millions of people, because, you know, there were only three channels back in the day, or four channels. And he just pulled out the TV Times from underneath his desk and started flicking through it, and just started like reading out, you know, previews of programmes coming up. And I think he was like kind of taking the mickey out of stuff as well. Am I remembering that correctly?
Obviously, one of the reasons for InVision continuity at the time was because more things went wrong in those days, and there was more sort of slack in the schedules, because programmes were of varying length, and they would often be odd gaps they'd have to fill. there was a famous example, I think, which was another example of when InVision continuity announcers really earned their corn, which was in the 80s. They were all showing a film, and for some reason, one of the reels had got missed out along the lines. So it actually finished much, much earlier, and there's who jump in the plot. And I know some of the announcers had to sort of ad-lib a précis of what had happened in the bit that nobody saw, just to get everything back on time. And so convenient, some of them had actually already seen it, so they could actually précis it. Some just had to sort of work out what was happening. So things did go wrong in those days, and they would have to think on their feet, and they would have to get the TV times out and go through it. And there was no way that sometimes it could go back. Sometimes the film would literally just fall off and not be able to come back, or just rip in half, and so they would have to have their wits about them. And this was sort of a byproduct of the days in television when things did go wrong as a matter of course, and you did have to have someone physically there, because there was a better than average chance there only one night there would be a mistake, or there would be a problem, and they would have to fill gaps.
So how strong do you think the identity of television channels is these days then? Because when I was growing up, there were three channels at first, and then in 1982, four channels. And so, really, you sort of knew what you were going to get with the different channels. BBC One was sort of mainstream stuff. BBC Two was a bit alternative, but on the safe side of alternative. ITV was very, very mainstream. Mm. And then Channel 4 was probably slightly more risque alternative. And then, of course, you had different styles of continuity on the channels, which you'd sort of get used to as well. Whereas nowadays, they're all kind of I don't know, I'm not sure I would say they're all the same, but certainly the way one programme segues into another seems very similar. I mean, you'll get the end credits, and you'll get maybe 2 seconds of the end credits, and then there'll be, I think, what they call a credit squeeze, where the screen kind of squashes up. On one side, you'll see the credits. You can't read them anymore because they're too small, but they're still scrolling past. And then on the right-hand side, it will be what are the other channels in the portfolio of the company that owns this channel. Mm. You know, if it's ITV, what's on ITV2, what's on ITV3, and they'll quickly rattle through that. And then it's the adverts. And then you're straight into the next programme again. And I never really get the feeling that there is that much of an identity of these channels. They're all pretty much interchangeable now, aren't they?
Well, it's interesting because when you go back to the 80s, I mean, obviously on ITV, all the programmes were prefaced by the logo of the company that made them. So if you're watching in the Southwest, or you're watching the Northeast, who didn't make so many programmes, you would see the Granada logo several times an evening, the Thames logo several times an evening, and you might probably see them more than you would TSW or Tyne Tees. But people still knew the channels, their regional channels, far more than they would refer to it as ITV. They would always refer to it as Westwood, or they would refer to it as Tyne Tees, even if over the course of the night they would see the idents of five or six different companies. And if you look at it now from a perspective, you're saying, well, what channel is this? Because it's showing so many different logos and so many different messages. And so it seems bizarre to think that was a time when people's connection to their ITV station was at its peak, when you would barely see its name even mentioned on screen. It was just the personalities of the announcers and of the surrounding detritus that would cement it in people's affections. So when you're now getting the brand hammered home at every opportunity, on ITV for example, you get the ITV brand, you get the logo on the screen all the time, and you get ITV, all the rest of ITV 2, 3 and 4, and you get all the brake bumpers and so on. And yet you don't have the connection that you did 20, 30 years ago, when people would call their regional station Granada or Central before they would refer to it as ITV.
Yeah, well, I remember adverts on ITV, on Granada, and you know, some of the companies would actually say, and this is where you can find our company in the Granada land region. I mean, it almost became a byword for the Northwest. It was many years, actually, before I realised that Granada is actually, isn't it, Spanish Island or something?
True, yeah, I mean, and in Yorkshire, of course, they always refer to it as the calendar region, if only because the region itself is much bigger than Yorkshire, so clearly to avoid confusion, they'll call them the calendar region, and they would continue to call it the calendar region just to avoid confusion or avoiding annoying people in Lincolnshire. But again, it the company names, even to this day, people you would probably see people, and they would still refer to their ITV company by its original name, even though they haven't been seen on screen for many, many years.
Yeah. So do you think that the decline of InVision continuity and the kind of genericisation of television presentation in general was probably inevitable? And do you think we just happened to live through what I would probably describe as a golden age, although, you know, people always think that when they were a kid it was a golden age, don't they? But I do sort of slightly feel like we've lost something here. But do you think it was inevitable?
I, I think so, yes. I mean, certainly in terms of ITV, as you say, the question is why have 15 different people saying the same thing into the same programme? We could just have one person in London saying it and everyone can listen to that, especially when the ITV stations started merging and taking over each other and it was clearly considered too much trouble than it was worth. But then, I mean, in the same time, there is some more informality in television because obviously the next few weeks we're going to be seeing all the Christmas logos, which in the past would only be on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day and Boxing Day. Now they run for a whole month and they have much more Christmas presentation. And then you have as well all the TV channels have their own Twitter accounts. And so, for example, BBC One's Twitter, when Bake Off is on, it will tweet jokes and it will tweet links to GIFs and things like soggy bottoms, which in the past you would never have got from a TV channel. They would have taken these things very, very seriously. So in a way, although the presentation itself has become much more regimented, TV channels in themselves have possibly become more informed with the way they speak to the public, and you maybe have that connection on a social media basis, Facebook and with Twitter, that in the past you would only be able to have on screen.
It's an interesting point, actually, because I have engaged with, I'm not sure I've engaged directly with a TV channel. I probably have added a TV channel in probably when I'm complaining about something. I don't ever remember seeing any of them responding, but I have certainly communicated with the Twitter accounts of different TV programmes. Mm. And sometimes you do get a response from them. So I suppose, in a way, that's actually a more intimate and two-way connection than you probably would have got back in the day, unless Colin Weston's reading out your birthday card, of course.
Well, I mean, you would have to write in those days and you would have to hope that there would be a slot for that they could talk about it, whereas now it's that you can contact them, and if they're a good channel, but unless they will get back to you, and they might actually have a proper conversation with you while the program is going on, which you never had in the past. Of course, you would have a connection with them with your station based on them coming into your home, but it was very much a one-way relationship in terms of they gave you what they thought you wanted to see, and they were not especially interested with what you had to say to the broadcaster.
Mm. I mean, do you think there's any chance that perhaps some enterprising TV channel somewhere could bring InVision Continuity back as a way of differentiating themselves from, from the other channels? I mean, if I think of something like, say, QVC, it's not a direct comparison, but actually, there are people who are fanatical about QVC and they'll sit there and watch it for hours and hours, not because they've got any intention of buying any of the products, but because they feel that connection, because you've got the same presenters on hour after hour and they're showing you how sparkly the jewellery is. Mm. And that's a level of intimacy that you don't often get, you know, a presenter directly speaking into the camera for that length of time. And so that's one way in which I suppose those shopping channels differentiate themselves. But I'm wondering if there might be some other channels out there that might think, do you know what, we might bring this back, because that might be a way in an era where you're probably only trying to get, you know, you're talking about thousands or tens of thousands of viewers rather than millions of viewers. That could be a way of differentiating themselves, couldn't it?
I mean, it's I suppose the reason why people love the radio in a way they don't love television programs, because they feel they have a relationship with radio because it's more intimate medium than television, and so they know and they love the presenters on radio, and they feel like they know them better than they do with the people on television. But I mean, there have been a few examples in recent years of channels trying to sort of experiment with InVision Continuity. I mean, BBC Three, when they relaunched a few years ago, they did very, very briefly InVision Continuity as a new thing, which lasted literally a matter of weeks before they realised it's a bit too much like hard work. And of course, in Northern Ireland, UTV still do some InVision Continuity as well. And it's sort of, I mean, a lot of television does come in cycles, and there are trends. And for example, in the news, for example, there were the trend for huge, big, massive studio sets, which made the news look really, really big and exciting. And then that went out of fashion, and it all came back down to being in real sets and quite small, intimate sets. And now suddenly there seems to be a move towards back towards huge, enormous sets, for example, in the BBC News. So these things come in cycles, and not to say that in years to come, or even in months to come, a company will say, actually, what might be quite nice is instead of having this logo here, it might be nice to have a real person here, and that would be a more intimate approach. And it would just be an experiment, and maybe it would be successful, maybe it wasn't. But these things often do come in cycles on television.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. I mean, I wondered if perhaps more specifically, rather than just say one of the random channels, you know, position number 69 on your remote control, actually one of the, or maybe more than one of the, these kind of hyperlocal stations that have come on stream last year. So I know there's London Live, that's the one that everyone always hears about, but there's quite a few of them dotted around the country, and some of them haven't even launched yet. And I think there is a question mark over whether some of the ones that haven't launched yet are ever going to launch. But there's one in Birmingham which is very good, actually. It's called Big Centre TV.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and that has quite a lot of television programmes on it that are quite good for kind of old-school TV geeks. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
they have a lot of people. Mike Prince, one of the ATV continuity announcers, I know, is actually involved in the running company, and they do have a lot of connection to the ATV archive.
Yeah.
And although whether a lot of what ATV were doing in the 70s works so well in a modern era is another thing.
But they haven't chosen to do InVision continuity. I've noticed, actually. They still do it behind a logo that looks like it's been created on a Commodore 64.
That's right. I mean, you've got Channel 4 now, and their current logo, in fact, they have a logo which in a way doesn't have the logo on it, because it doesn't have the Channel 4 logo in it, and there is the marketing speak that goes on that, saying, well, this is a new way of doing our presentation, in that we don't have the actual Channel 4 logo physically there, but we give it across via the elements of the logo and the way we do it. So it's not to say that someone can't say, well, we can have presentation which doesn't have to be our logo, and it doesn't be that, it can just be a person, and this person will epitomise what the ethos of the channel is. Although obviously you would have to decide what your ethos of your channel was, and you'd have to find the right kind of person to do it.
Indeed. Okay. Well, that's been a fascinating discussion for me. Steve, I mean, I'll try and get some feedback from listeners as to to how many other people are as fascinated about this as I am. But I think it's important to kind of just take stock and pause and just look back at stuff like this, because things that were prevalent and very common like this, and then they kind of disappear. And I think it's important to just kind of take a couple of steps back and just think about why that is. I think there's a lot of trends in kind of culture and television and radio, and that we'll probably be looking back in 20 or 30 years at some of the stuff that was on, that's on the internet right now, and we'll be looking back on that and thinking how quaint that is. But I think it's been a great discussion. Thanks for your time, Steve.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mark. Glad to join you tonight.
Okay, so thanks for listening tonight. I've been talking about VoteSat 16 with Henry Hill of the website Conservative Home. We also touched upon the budget, and also I was talking to Steve Williams about InVision continuity and stuff to do with old school television as general. So wide diversity of subjects tonight, but that's what we like here. Let's get some good coverage. Everyone else is talking about the budget, and we touched upon it, but we covered some other topics as well. I'll be back here next week.